I have, on my other side, I'm a documentary filmmaker.
Oh.
So one of the documentaries I'm doing is called The Doodle Life.
Oh.
And I talked to Art about being in it a couple of years ago, and we were still trying to get together. But I was wondering if you wouldn't mind saying that, you know, since you deal with all these artists, what the doodle life is, and you have your own doodle life.
I guess so.
Would you be comfortable talking?
Sure. Well, doodle is a good word because it involves play. It implies play, and I think at the root of it is the pleasure of making something without worrying about what it will be and finding out in the making what it is. So that's the original creative process, is about as raw as it gets. I mean, actually a cartoon is an idea sketch for a painting by Michelangelo. That's what a cartoon is, the definition of the word. And a doodle, I guess, is the most visible expression of creative imagining something, and you're following, your hand is making it, and then you are seeing what your hand made. So it's a good topic.
Now, you know, it's interesting because, and you reminded me of something, a quote that I love, that somebody asked Monet a question about how he starts a painting or something like that, and he said, I have this idea in my mind, but my hand has another idea, and I follow it.
Yeah, and there's a jazz musician, I don't remember which one, but one of the greats who said, well, I'll play it first and I'll tell you what it is later. And that's, you know, the essence of jazz, and it's the essence of being able to doodle. And for me, like, when I'm, for example, at Raw or at the Time or at the New Yorker now with Toon Books, I'm in touch with many different artists, including people who have, like, superb craft and skills, but the ones that I'm interested in talking to is the ones who doodle, because it's the ones who actually are watching their own ideas come up to the surface, as opposed to another breed of artist who waits for an assignment and to be told what to do. And they may be very good at doing it, but I don't have a dialogue with them because it's not interesting for me to tell them what to do, but I'm very interested if they are generous enough to show me their doodles. I have this constant back and forth with artists where I say, send me black and white rough thumbnails. And they say, but you know, can't I email you a finished rendering? And I say, no, because then you're going to get caught up in whether it's red or pink or blue or orange or whatever, which is not relevant to me getting a sense of what your idea is. What I want is a raw expression, something done quickly. And if the idea is appealing, then we can spend time figuring out whether it's red or pink or orange. And also it will be a guide. You know, it will be the cartoon version of what the idea is, and we can use it as we refine it to make it into a publishable image. We can use it as, is this connected to what the artist is trying to say? Because again, the connection between drawing and thinking is what makes it so vital.
I agree. I'm glad to hear you articulate that, because I think you being with the New Yorker and you picking art for their cover and for all their artwork has an inside view. And also being French is a whole other... I lived in France. Je parle très mauvais, cinq langues, comme un bas espagnol. But I find that the mindset is so different.
Mm-hmm.
So you being a New Yorker, a French New Yorker, mm-hmm. is a very interesting mixture.
Well, I think it's, from my personal experience, it may not be for everybody, but for me it works to be a foreigner. I love the fact that I have a foot in each culture. What is nice is that it actually gives you like a vantage point a little bit outside of it, and you see more when you are parachuted in the middle of Paris and you have to get from point A to point B. you notice a million different things. And if you're in your daily life in New York and you're trying to get from point A to point B, you are blind from like repeated exposure to so many things. And similarly, like what I see myself, my goal is either in the kids' books or in World Magazine or in the New Yorker work is a kind of filter and distiller and a catalyst for images that capture some things, that have meanings, that actually become anchor points for other people. One of the privileges I had at the New Yorker was to be Sol Steinberg's editor. And I learned a lot from Steinberg, and I miss him a lot, but he talked about the fact that some of his ideas, not all of them, but some of them were so potent that they shaped the way people think. For example, like the view of the world from 9th Avenue gives you the vantage point of a provincial New Yorker who sees the rest of the world in this receding perspective. And he says, once you've seen this image, you can't remember how you thought before you saw it, because now it's a meme, you know, now it's something in your head, and you can be in Columbus, Ohio, and you can see the view of the world from Columbus, Ohio in that shape. So those are building blocks, and it's an extraordinary gift that the artist has, that he can actually plant little seeds in people's mind who have seen his images. And a lot of other like people in the art world or filmmakers, other artists have powers that is important, but visual artists who work for reproduction have a tool when they know how to use it well. That is amazing, and the means to accomplish that is a pen and a piece of paper. And it's medieval. It's actually like in antiquity they could do this. And to me it's akin to like poetry and design rather than, it's not just words and picture, but it's distilled words and distilled images. And those can really like get very deeply into one's brain because they are just skeletal and essential. So they really, it's a hugely potent set of vocabulary, like so much can be done with it, and so few people are even aware that they are the receiving end of this. And poetry does that. Like you can have a haiku and it has an extraordinary world of understanding and feeling. So I think it's deceptive because it's perceived intuitively. Nobody has to teach you in school how to read a cartoon, and you know, kids read them that way, and as a result they assume that, oh, that's easy. If it's easy to read, it's easy to make, but that actually it's probably in inverse proportion, the same way as poetry is not easy. Part of it is it's a amount of choice that is made, and then within that form you can do something. And that's why I like a thing that's happening now in visual arts that has to do with construction of reality, trying to make like 3D objects seen and rotated in space, kind of reconstructing of reality that looks very realistic, leaves me cold. But I'm much more interested by a Fleischer cartoon from like 1900, you know, 1910, like that kind of like where you still see the hand of the artist, that just moves me in a way that feels like it goes to my gut.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, one of the things I'm looking at is how we're going to experience media in the future.
Well, I think it's interesting for me, like being between the two cultures. I find that Americans are unaware of so many of their strengths, and it's an incredibly visual culture that has almost no vocabulary to speak about images and takes itself for granted, which is not the worst thing in the world. It doesn't sit around like...
Well, we're a young culture.
Yes. And as such, it still produces things intuitively. as opposed to the French who are trying to rationally arrive.
The French could think something to death.
Yeah, exactly.
But I love it because they're actually thinking. We haven't been taught to think. We don't really know how. It's not part of our culture. Whereas it's part of your culture. Just from my, and I think it would be interesting for that to doing something for children.
Well, you know, children is a very vast field because young children are not self-conscious, and that's a huge asset because they can just...
They believe in everything.
Do things. Like, you know, there's a strange thing when you become grown up, and I guess it's part of the socializing, mm-hmm. and everybody works at socializing their children, the teachers, and
right,
the parents.
Right, and they don't realize what they're doing.
But you do become, like, if you look at something, if you hear your voice on a phone recorder, if you look at something that you have written or drawn, it's almost like a repulsion. It's like, ooh, mm-hmm. how did I do that? And like, whereas your, you know, brother or sister's handwriting doesn't bring out the same kind, or their doodle doesn't look that awful. And I think, I mean, it's a strange kind of thing. And I think artists have to learn to do the opposite. They have to learn to just stop that censure from, like, making them crumple it up and put it in the garbage, and then they have to like let it be, look at it with a objective point of view and say, well, actually, like, this is kind of interesting, and then reshape it into something that other people can see. So they have to externalize their voice in a way so that it can communicate to other people. With children, like, you can see that moment where they all know how to draw, they all love to draw, it flows. It's not, again, it's not something they need to be taught, and it's something that the minute they start looking at it, they stop. You know, and it's about 8, 9 years old, they become self-conscious, and all of a sudden, they think of it as like somebody else's. And the cartoonists are all the ones who just didn't stop.
Yeah, they didn't grow up in some way.
Well, in
their heart.
They didn't grow up. Let's say that they found some way to keep that editor and that's no good, that is good, or whatever, in a way that it just didn't turn off the faucet. Where, okay, so some things are good, some things are not. Like, the better artists, almost all of them, as an editor, I don't need to tell them what's good and what's not. They all know it. Sometimes they just bullshit me because they would like me to publish something. But it's very rare that somebody who's good says, like, oh, I did this great piece, and I look at it and like, oh no, he didn't. I mean, they pretty much have some sense of when they're onto something, when they're repeating themselves. Like, one of the things that I had with Steinberg, who desperately wanted to keep that faucet open of his own doodles, of his own ideas, was looking, because it was at the end of his life, was looking through like 3,000 or 4,000 drawings that he had in drawers to try to find something that would be a good idea that he hadn't done yet, because he didn't want to repeat himself. And once he had had a thought and he had brought it together as painting or a cover for the New Yorker or whatever, he didn't want to do another variation on that. And we found things which he then turned into covers, but it's difficult as an artist to keep that flow of discovering new things where you're surprising yourself.
Well, that's part of interesting. That's one of the reasons why I'm doing the documentary on mm-hmm. the doodle life, because mm-hmm. I think it's inspirational in the sense that people might surprise themselves.
Well, you have to,
yeah. And that's really,
that's
to me,
a trap. I mean, it's a trap for true artists. I mean, there are artists who can actually like develop a style. I mean, if they're stylist, and then they're being asked to do that style, and it can be frustrating to a true artist because what is being asked of them is what they did 10 years ago, and that's not where they are at.
But tell me a little bit about Saul. What was he like? What?
Steinberg, I mean, he was a true gentleman. You know, he grew up in Romania, and he escaped during World War II. He was a Jew, and he managed to escape and go to Italy, where he studied architecture, and then things got bad in Italy as well. So he got on a boat, and tried to get into the US and was denied. So he stayed on some island offshore with, you know, a lot of other Jewish refugee. And eventually William Shawn, who was the editor of the New Yorker, arranged to get him a visa so he could come. He had very few things published. He was like 22 or 23, and he remained eternally grateful to Shawn and to the New Yorker, because it literally saved his life and let him in. So he had that set of feeling and gratitude toward the magazine, and he also had, I'm trying to remember if it was his uncle or somebody in his family when he was a kid in Romania, who was a printer and box maker, so there was objects being made. It wasn't like he grew up in that house, but he spent time in the shop where they were making stationery and boxes and things to wrap. And he had something that I share, which is a love of like making things, making objects. So, and he had no bigger pleasures than he gave me a drawing, and then I turned it into a printer's group, and then I would bring it over to him, all marked up with like, not move this here, erase that, like big fat marker on top of the proof. That made him really happy to see his work. And he was friends, and he could have turned himself into a Jackson Pollock or, you know, a fine artist, but his love of print and his gratitude to the New Yorker got him wedded to this art for reproduction, and probably also his European origins, because there's less of a downgrading if you work for reproduction. That's a very American thing, like in Europe they don't, whereas in America I've talked to fine artists who actually didn't want to be published in the New Yorker because they were afraid it would bring down the value of their work, which would be inconceivable in Europe as even a concern. So Saul spent a lot of time, he had gallery shows and he saw things, but a lot of his thinking life, of his real conceptual life, was also words in picture, because he spoke incredibly well. I mean, he was such a good conversationalist. Few people have managed to, like, it was almost impossible to capture, because it was the art of conversation. So you can write it down. There was one of the New Yorker writers who went over and actually wore a wire and recorded him, and when he found out, he was furious. It was a gift. So he would invite me over, we would make an appointment, and I would go for the afternoon, and he appreciated the fact that I dressed up, and it was a social call. Liked that, of, you know, course. That somehow, like, as opposed to like, oh yeah, she would like send a messenger over. So, and then I would go over to his house, and first we would sit, and I would listen to him. He would make me a coffee, and then I would listen to his take on the OJ affair or whatever was in the news. So, you know, his thoughts about death and dying. And I wish I could have been wearing a wire, but he had been very specific that he didn't want anybody to do that or take notes. So it forced me to like really pay attention, and it was such a gift.
How do you think Saul Steinberg saw himself?
It's a good question. I think he was very, as a European, he was very particular about his friendship. So he loved America with a passion. It saved his life. You know, as soon as he arrived here, he enrolled as a GI, and he was sent to China. And so he had, you know, he drew American flags and, you know, statues of liberties and eagles and all of this paraphernalia. He liked all of the marks of decorum, so he liked all those symbols and how to express very strong emotion with rubber stamps and just factory-made tools that are then made to express something very personal and powerful. And he was at heart a cartoonist, and since I did go through his work, like, I could see he paid a lot of attention. He wasn't friends with too many other artists. He was friends with many writers. and that very close friendship. He didn't suffer fools gladly, so he kept himself rather isolated, which became more difficult for him at the end of his life. He had a very unique and sophisticated point of view. He took the time to figure out, to think things through. He had the same exact kind of things that manifested itself into setting up an appointment. He was well matched with a New Yorker because it was also, it gave him both of what he wanted, which was a forum, because it had a large circulation and his images really spread out into the world, including The New Yorker has a great pass-along readership because it's in doctor's offices, and if you do a cover for the magazine, it's seen by millions of people. But it had a humble place to live, which was just a magazine cover that fitted his appraisal of himself. He took himself seriously, but not in any way anything unwarranted. He knew his strengths, he knew his liability, and he just wanted a civilized place to be a gentleman of the 20th century. And in that sense, like, I think his place in the 20th century, and because of that rejection of the artists such as Jackson Pollock, he was friends with Rauschenberg also, they were young men together. I know those people are more well known. I think Soul is actually more characteristic of his century because that media creature of the Andy Warhol, Jackson Pollock was known by the idea of what he does rather than concrete realization is more 19th century than 20th century. Like there's a humility to how Soul made his place in the world that, again, this thing of like, I'll just do a magazine cover and it will impact the way people think, that was pretty profound.
Interesting, but only the elite knew of Andy Warhol and
exactly.
And but everybody knew who.
Well, his stuff was imitated on Canal Street and it was parodied. And as much as he didn't like being parodied because he liked control his own drawings, he understood how broad a reach he had. His love of America involved that love of people, like of not just wanting to be a toy for the elite.
So it's interesting to hear your perspective on the two cultures.
Well, I think as an exile, and that's what you get,
right.
You know.
Like, but I think
it somehow, when I was here the first few years and I couldn't speak English and everything was a struggle, the simplest thing, like the worst thing that could happen to me is that I would get in an elevator and someone would say, "Hi, how are you doing?" And it's like, oh,
no,
How do you use language to say nothing? I didn't know how to do that. But what it taught me is not so much that I was a great connoisseur of life in America, but it taught me so much about myself. Because all of a sudden I realized, like, oh, that's not me, that's just the French part. You know, that's like the shell that happens to have been shaped that way because of place that I grew in. So now, like, I can't say that I have more of a perspective on who I am, but I have more indulgence for some quirks. I can get irritated and I realize, oh, but like he's American or she's French or whatever. It's like, it's not that person, it's just one facet.
In the sense of what you were saying about being an exile, I would feel that way if I didn't have the understanding, because I've lived in many different cultures. I think of myself as international. I don't think of myself as nationalism. I have a big problems with nationalism anyway. Mm-hmm. My greatest dream is that maybe one day all the leaders of the world will decide they have a war, you know, because that's what they do, and nobody will show up. But Saul had a very interesting political observation too, didn't he?
You know, like he was very, he had quirky interest that came of his personal history. Like, he was so interested in language. He spoke French. We sometimes spoke in French rather than in English. He spoke Italian, of course. Romanian is very close to Latin.
Very close.
He spoke English very well, but he so chose his word. He spoke so well in every language. And one of his passion, like really genuine interest, was pidgin.
Pidgin English?
Pidgin English.
Oh,
yeah,
I love it.
Pidgin English is a mongrel language.
Like Spanglish or
yeah, yeah. Pidgin and any kind of patois, and a lot of his images he would give to me was made up names for countries and words, and a lot of them, I would put them through the New Yorker checkers, and then I would find out that half of it wasn't so made up. Those were words of pidgin and patois and like ways of making you realize that all of those things are actually constructs and not just the only way the reality can be.
It's interesting in talking to you, you get a sense of a joie de vivre, that he really had a sense of humor that was at the core of all of his playfulness.
Yes, absolutely. The playfulness, that was his other interest that was related to your topic of doodles, is he lived for children's drawing. He made himself, even though he had stuff sold at Pace Gallery and stuff in museums and whatever, but he forced himself to only use like a box of Crayola from the corner drugstore, I think some art supply store, nothing fancy, and a number two pencil and some regular like Canson paper, just or typing paper, and to use those tools to render his idea, because it was important to not isolate himself in this ivory tower of the artist, and to go back to that root of like, I'm gonna scribble this thing because that's how I'm gonna understand it myself. And when you have a kid that lives through something traumatic, you're not gonna get them to try to sit there and put it into words, because it would be too difficult to put it in sentences. But you give them a pen and a piece of paper, and you tell them to fill in the notebooks and doodle. And that's, in that sense, he was very inspiring. He was an artist as well as somebody who communicated. And that's somebody whose work inspired other artists. But that's because he, again, never lived in that isolated places that he had earned, but that he always went back to the core. And vice versa, he also looked at other artists' work. Like, you can see if you look at the body of his work, the moment where he discovers Robert Crumb, and you can see how it changes his, actually his old generation of painters' mode of representation, how it like revitalizes him, and he's trying to get some of that energy, but he's like, oh yeah, yeah, this is, yes, I forgot, it's all this stuff. And what Crumb did is bring back the vernacular onto the drawing table as a possible, like Crumb was in the late 60s when Crumb starts getting published. It has nothing to do with the 60s and what is happening at the time, but what Crumb is really into is stuff from the 20s, the music of the times, the handmade signs, all of early industrial objects, but that are made by hand. The hand lettering, Crumb is a superb letterer, and he looks at this, and Popeye as a comic strip, that's also a very quirky strip by Segar, before it gets to be mechanized and before it gets to be modular and reproduced. And that's what he brings onto at the forefront of like the underground comics movement, which Crumb spearheaded and which inspired Art, my husband, and inspired many of the great artists of the time. It was about the individual expression, whereas everything around them at the time was getting it right, you know, and getting it in some ways that was anonymous.
Did he ever meet Calder?
Yeah, they actually were friends.
Because I could just see, because when you were talking about making artwork for his kids,
yeah,
Yeah. I could just see him loving Calder.
Yeah, no, he actually, he didn't have children, but he always kept in touch with other people's kids and children's drawings in general. But he and Calder were actually genuinely close friends. He had a Calder sculpture that Calder had made for him. And they both had that same desire of just using pieces of coat hangers and simple things.
Were you there when they met at all? Were you ever?
Calder, no, that preceded me. They met as young men.
But I would have liked to have been there.
Yeah.
That would have been a beautiful moment in time. You know what I'd like to do is continue this with you on a number of different things and just do it as just a conversation.
Okay.
You know, in the sense of, because there's so many different things, and I love the story of Saul, because he's such an inspiration and such
a
dreamer.
He really is, yeah.
And I didn't realize his life story.
Yeah.
How old was Saul when he died?
83 or 84, somewhere like that.
Would it be possible because you have an insight that most people probably don't have into.
Well, he had a few close friends.
Right, but you were also were part of his art.
You know, the message board guys to see you.
And we're possible to actually go and see some of the artwork.
Everything is in repository, and there's a woman who takes care of it, and she runs the Saul Steinberg Foundation, so
right.
I can put you in something that we call the vault in Queens, so yes, mm-hmm. It's possible. He had a hard time becoming close to anybody new towards the end of his life. I'm one of the last few people he let into his inner circle, but that was Sandy Frazier. Ian Frazier was a writer for The New Yorker and a superb writer. And they were close, they were really close, and would go on expeditions together and so on and so forth. So it would be worth talking to.
Well, let's see if we can do this together maybe.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff in here.
Okay.
And it's some wonderful stuff, and it also reveals your intuitive sense as well.
Well, I mean, I will echo what you just said. I feel I'm really lucky. I get to do what I love. That's my only mandate, is like, make sure you keep interested. And I think last year I was doing a little mini tour with Robert Crumb, because he had his book on Genesis coming out. So we went to Richmond, Virginia, and Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and did something in New York. So I got to spend like a week with him, and we were in a different city every single day, and that is exhausting. It's even inconceivable when then you have to be on stage and have to project. You don't even remember who you are, let alone having to like inhabit that persona. And he did it very well, and I was like, and then we had downtime when we were in the plane and traveling, and he had very vivid memory of like specific moments, you know, that he could recount. And I was like, Robert, this is so inspiring, because I remember nothing. I work so hard, I don't take time to live through any one moment. I forget people's name or what happened or when it happened. And Robert said that's part of his routine, is to remember. First of all, when he's living through something, he takes notes. And second of all, he lives a rather monastic life. And part of his life every day is actually looking back at old notebooks and making an act of remembering as like what happened. Okay, that was the summer of 1971. I was in that place, I was with those people, and giving it the mental space to revive those memories. And as a result, he actually is one of the few people that I know who very truly is himself. And that's one of the hard things, is to not let other people tell you what you should be. It's a difficult task, especially when you are successful and you're constantly assailed by people's expectation of what you should be for them. But he manages to do it by actually cultivating his own memory, and I'm sure he's never going to have Alzheimer's. I mean, whatever the physical symptoms are, he'll be able to remember things.
It's interesting. I was just with, and I'm doing a documentary called Music Saved My Life, Conversations Over Dinner with self-described bipolar bear, James Cassell. And James Cassell has an incredible memory. One of the things is people who have these kind of memory think,
it's a way of compensating for their whatever is going on in their mind. So they use it as a medicine often. They know such details, such minutiae. He remembers things when he was 4 years old. He remembers poems that he read 6 or 7 years old. Just an incredible, insightful guy who's traumatized by his own memories and by life. And I think Crumb also had his own issues.
Yeah.
But it would be great to weave all these things in. I really appreciate our conversation here.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed our
well, thank you.
So I need to do one thing.
Yeah.
Besides for taking a picture of you, is okay if I use this in a documentary?
Yes, it is.
And your name?
My name is Françoise Mouly.
And how do you spell that?
FrancoiseMouly.
And email?
And there's a cedilla under the seat.
There's a what?
A cedilla under
the seat. Okay, good, great. So I'm going to take a couple pictures. We're in the same... let's see.
I'd love to follow up on talking with Art.
Yeah, he's not, because he's not talking to anyone, because he's working on a book, so that's great. So as soon as that book is out.
But remind us, I talked to him about the doodle light.
Right.
Was that one of Mocha's things?
No, he's just, right now, like, it's great because he actually has a deadline, has to bring things to the printer.
How long have you guys been married now?
We've been together since 1976, so 34 years, I guess.
That's a long time.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'll send you an email as things move forward.
That's great.
Appreciate it.